Hi, and welcome to the McGregor Dementia Support Ministry podcast, a podcast providing relevant resources to those currently walking the dementia journey with their loved ones. Today's podcast is a session recorded from our Alzheimer's and Dementia Seminar held here at McGregor Baptist Church on February the 18th, 2024. Today's podcast session is titled, Where Can We Find Hope? By Dr. Benjamin Mast.
I want to start just to say how thankful I am to be here today, and thankful to Kim Mitchell for this. It's really encouraging to me, and that my book could be a small part of it is something that I'll take with me for a long time. I want to start with a story this morning. I've told this story many, many times, and in fact, I've told it so many times that about 5 years ago, I promised I would stop telling the story. It's part of my story. It's part of a story of Alzheimer's disease. And as I was traveling here, I thought, I need to tell this story again. Maybe there's something in this story that people need to hear, even if it's been told many times before. So I grew up in Western Michigan, Grand Rapids, son of a pastor, and he's originally from Denver, Colorado. And when I was a young boy, we would take trips to go visit my grandparents in Denver, head up into the mountains, do some fishing, good things. And as we got older, we stopped making the trip, and they started making the trip to come see us, my grandparents. And somewhere around late middle school, we started to notice something was a little different about my grandfather. He would start in with questions. He wanted to catch up on my brother and I, what we were up to. You know, how's school? How's basketball? You got a girlfriend? Do you have a job? Those were important questions to him, good questions for a grandfather to ask. But one year when he came, he asked us those questions, and then about 15 minutes later, he started in again. He said, how's basketball? Do you got a girlfriend? Where are you working? Back in the days where middle schoolers worked, right? So, and it was confusing for my brother and I. We were young, we didn't get it. And so we'd look at my dad and he'd say, well, you know, he just doesn't hear very well, so if you could just speak up, he won't keep asking you the same question again. It's like, okay, give it a shot. And it, as you might have guessed, given where we are today, it didn't work, right? Speaking up didn't work. So the visit ends. They come back again the next summer. He's still asking the same questions over and over. Look at Dad, it's his dad. He says, you've got to speak up. And I say, yeah, Dad, we got that, but we're really speaking pretty loudly at this point. He said, well, here's the thing. He's not paying attention, right? He's asking the question, and by the time you get around to answering it, he's getting distracted. And so if you could just speak up, hold his attention, you know, he'll stop asking the same question. So. Again, you may have guessed it didn't work. But things went on that way for quite some time, and we said, you know, he's got hearing problems, you know, maybe he's got, you know, some other medical problems, but the big answer was just not there on our radar, right? And so the other thing I want you to know about my grandfather, he was a retired plumber. He was a member of the Denver Plumbers Union, and every Tuesday afternoon, despite his lack of hearing and his inability to pay attention, he continued to drive downtown into those meetings. It was a good social outlet, and so I imagine everybody thought this would be a good thing for him to do. But that night of one Tuesday, he didn't return when it got dark, and nobody knew where he was. And it wasn't in a great part of town. People assumed something, you know, really horrible may have happened to him, and it was really scary. No one knew what had happened to my grandfather. But the next day we got a good break, and the sheriff called and said that they had found him and he was okay. It wasn't the sheriff of Denver though, it was the sheriff of a little tiny town in Kansas about 300 miles away. So what had happened, we don't know, but somewhere between leaving for the meeting, he got in his car and he drove 300 miles pulled up to a small farmhouse, walked inside, found a comfortable recliner, and fell asleep. So there's an older woman who lives there by herself. She hears the door open and close, and she knows this is not, no one else lives here, something's wrong. And she walks in and finds my grandfather asleep, somehow gets a hold of his driver's license, contacts the police, they somehow connect back to Denver, and the family goes to find him, call off the search. And, his explanation is, what's the big deal? I went for a drive, right? And so you may have guessed by now, but my grandfather, he did have hearing problems and he did have a hard time paying attention, but he had been developing Alzheimer's disease for many years. And we just didn't recognize it. And even if we did recognize it, maybe we weren't prepared to accept it. Alzheimer's disease is something that we don't want to see in our lives, right? And it develops so slowly over time that it can be very subtle at first. And then for some of us, there's a big event like driving 300 miles away that says, okay, I need to pay attention. This is something significant. So I tell the story partly because it's part of my own introduction to this disease, but I think it demonstrates some important things about Alzheimer's disease. One is, as I said, it comes on very gradually. We don't even notice at first. And in this first hour together, we're going to talk about why that might be. The other part is it just can be incredibly scary. It can be scary for families, and so we're reluctant to consider what might be going on. And I'm sure it was also scary for my grandfather, right? He's in the middle of nowhere. I'm sure he didn't know where he was. Maybe he thought he knew where he was. But it is a very significant challenge. And medically, maybe spiritually, it's one of the biggest challenges of our day. Whether you are older or whether you are middle-aged and worried about the future or taking care of a parent or a spouse, it's very heavy. And so the things that we're going to talk about today may be very difficult, especially if you've never heard them. And so what I wanted to do, if we could, is just start to talk about some expectations. Spoke yesterday at Bay Presbyterian down the road, and I said to them, and I'll say it to you, sometimes I hate to share some of these things with you because we're going to cover some difficult material when we talk about Alzheimer's disease. And if it's the first time you've heard it, I just want to say, I know this is hard. But I want you to stick with me because we're going to talk about what to expect in Alzheimer's disease. We'll talk a little bit about what to expect from some of the medications that are old and some of them that are new. But ultimately, we're going to talk about hope, as Pastor Mark said. So when we talk about expectations, I thought we could just start very briefly with a little bit of Ephesians 3. And I just want to take a moment to read it with you because I think there's something for us here. So Ephesians 3, this is starting in verse 14. For this reason I kneel before the Father, from whom every family in heaven on earth derives its name. I pray that out of his glorious riches he may strengthen you with power through his Spirit in your inner being, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith. And I pray that you, being rooted and established in love, may have power together with all the Lord's holy people. Together, you're not alone. To grasp how wide and long and high and deep is the love of Christ, and to know this love that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled to the measure of all the fullness of God. And I want you to hear this. Now to him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine, according to his power that is at work within us, to him be glory in the church and in Jesus Christ throughout all generations, forever and ever. Amen. So let's get into the material. It's going to be difficult, but I hope that you will remember, one, that we are together in this. That's why I'm so thankful for something like this, There's 200 other people here who are on the journey or who care about you on the journey. There are people here to offer resources that can help you. One of the hardest things of Alzheimer's is going at it alone. So I would strongly encourage you. You need other people, and you need the Lord to journey with you. So let's jump into Alzheimer's disease. This first session is going to be about an hour. It will be an hour, Kim. And we'll be back in the afternoon. So this morning, we're going to talk about what Alzheimer's disease is. We're going to talk about some basic facts, and we're going to start to talk about what biblical hope looks like for living with Alzheimer's disease. This afternoon, we're going to talk about family caregiving and the role of the church. Let's start out with the basics. So what is dementia? I get this question quite often. What's the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's disease? I also do dementia evaluations. Sometimes families will say to me, he doesn't have Alzheimer's disease, he just has a little bit of dementia. So what's the difference? It's important. So dementia is what we call a syndrome. That is a series of symptoms that occur together. So in the context of dementia, it is decline in memory and other cognitive abilities, thinking skills, your ability to plan, problem solve, speak, and understand language. And a dementia syndrome has a variety of causes. There are many different types of dementia. But we distinguish dementia from normal age-related change. You may have heard this. You know, as people get older, memory changes, right? We all know this by now. Memory changes, our thinking speed changes, and it begins earlier than we would like to admit. It starts in middle age. But it's usually pretty subtle, and people find ways to compensate for it. They remain independent. In dementia, it's severe enough that it interferes with people's independence and daily functioning. So if you're working, it interferes with job performance. If you are retired, we look at things like, has it interfered with your ability to manage your money? To remember to pay bills, but also to remember that you've already paid them. To remember to take your medication, also remember that you already took them. Right? So if you have significant memory problems and you're managing your own medication, you might not only forget to take them, but you also might take them multiple times because you forgot that you took them in the first place. It can be pretty dangerous. So the point of dementia is to say this is a decline, it's a problem with memory and other cognitive skills, and it interferes with your daily functioning. It's hard to remain independent with dementia, and it's different from normal aging. We all change. This is a more significant change. With dementia, there are multiple types. Alzheimer's disease is the most common type or cause of dementia. 60 to 80% of people who have dementia have underlying Alzheimer's disease causing it. It's one of the reasons why we tend to use the terms interchangeably, is because most cases of dementia are caused by Alzheimer's. There are other types. Some of them are listed on the screen. Vascular dementia is due to vascular damage in the brain, things like strokes or silent strokes. Dementia with Lewy bodies is a little bit like a cross between Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease. Frontotemporal dementia happens in a little bit younger, 50s and 60s, often characterized by dramatic personality change, sort of the loss of social filter. People say and do whatever pops into their head, and be very painful and difficult. And finally, it's worth noting, if you drink heavy enough for long enough, you can pickle your brain in alcohol and cause a progressive dementia. So there are many types. Alzheimer's is just one of them. It's the form of dementia that we know the most about, although there are things about it that are still a bit of a mystery. And I just want to give you some basics as to what Alzheimer's disease is and how it affects people. This is the part that I said, you know, these things, if you haven't heard them before, can be pretty painful and hard to take. But we need to cover it before we can start to talk about how to live with it. So Alzheimer's disease in its typical form comes on as gradual short-term memory loss. So in the case of my grandfather, that repeated questioning over and over is a function of not remembering that he asked the same question several minutes ago. It doesn't always show up as repetitive questioning, but this is the typical presentation, that people start forgetting information, and typically it's recent things, things that happened today, things that happened in the last few weeks. The older memories, as we'll talk about, tend to hang around for much, much longer. These memory problems, they come on gradually, as I said, and they will progressively get worse. These are caused by underlying microscopic changes in the brain. They're just incredibly tiny, but their effects sometimes seem larger than life. We'll talk about what these are in just a moment, but what is important to know about Alzheimer's disease, it's both fascinating and terrifying at the same time, is that these changes in the brain begin decades before we start to show symptoms. So what that means is people who are living without any cognitive problems, no forgetfulness more than anybody else, functioning fully independently, can be developing Alzheimer's in their brain, and it's not going to show up for another 10 to 20 years. This used to just be an idea that Alzheimer's scientists thought was interesting and might play out. Now there's good evidence to show that this is actually true. So there is a period of time where the brain is changing and we don't know it. So what's happening in the brain? This is going to be a very short neurology lesson. But I want you to be aware of what the basic changes are that are happening in the brain. The first is the development of what we call amyloid plaques. And so if you're following Alzheimer's disease developments, you'll know that amyloid is a really big deal, or at least we think it is. In these images, you're looking at the outside of a neuron here, and outside of it is this little blue squiggly line which represents amyloid precursor protein. It's a normal part of a healthy brain cell neuron, and in Alzheimer's disease, for unknown reasons, if you can see this, there's a little tiny scissors here. That's an enzyme that is snipping that protein into fragments, and those proteins cluster together into what we call an amyloid plaque. The brain can't clear the plaque out. It disrupts the communication between those brain cells, and those cells die. So this is the earliest change that's happening in brains of people with Alzheimer's disease, at least that we've identified, and it's one of the hallmark changes that, in a sense, is Alzheimer's disease. The second is the development of neurofibrillary tangles. And this involves a different protein that we call tau. Again, maybe it's a little hard to see. My vision's not as good as it used to be either. But within a neuron, you have a long branching structure. Think of it a little bit like a train track. It transports nutrients along the length of the cell. And on the outside of this little train track, you have, again, some little blue squiggly lines. That's tau protein. For unknown reasons, that protein breaks off, the train track falls apart, and the brain can't transport nutrients in the cell anymore, and it leads to cell death. So two different causes of cell death in brains of people with Alzheimer's disease: amyloid plaques, neurofibrillary tangles. Amyloid and tau are the two key proteins. For some of you, this is way too much detail about this, but if you could take a little take-home point here is, Alzheimer's disease is a very real neurobiological condition. It's associated with these very specific, very microscopic changes that are so small they can't be seen on a standard brain scan, right? They're incredibly tiny. But this is what Alzheimer's is at its most basic level. It leads to the third change in brains of people with Alzheimer's disease, and that's what people will call neurodegeneration. Another way of thinking about it is atrophy, or shrinkage of the brain tissue. So I said that the plaques and tangles lead to cell death. That leads to just a significant atrophy of brain tissue. So this is what's happening in the brains of people with Alzheimer's disease. So those three changes, amyloid, tau, and neurodegeneration, sometimes you'll see those three letters, A, T, N, to signify what's happening. So I said earlier, these begin before people start to show symptoms. And so on this slide, you can see the declines that we would expect with normal aging. Right? You should expect that there will be change. But the departure of Alzheimer's disease is a more significant decline. And there is a long period where the brain is changing and memory is not. And we call that preclinical Alzheimer's disease. And so if you ever see that term, essentially what you're talking about is Alzheimer's without symptoms, right? And this is going to be a big focus coming in the next 10, 20 years in relation to assessment and treatment. But for now, when we're talking about Alzheimer's, we're either talking about it in the form of mild cognitive impairment or dementia, like I said earlier. Dementia, decline significant enough to interfere with daily functioning. MCI, which we haven't talked about, and I should say what it is very briefly, is not quite dementia. It's a gray area between normal aging and dementia, where people have some cognitive problems, but they're still independent. Sometimes it's caused by Alzheimer's disease, and sometimes it's not. And perhaps we can talk more about that if there are questions later. Okay. So as people live longer with it, these plaques and tangles spread. We've got three brain images here. Early, you can see just a little tiny bit of blue shading in the temporal lobes, a little bit more in middle. This doesn't show up very well, but it's spreading to the frontal lobes, parietal. And in late stage dementia, it's really spread widely throughout the whole brain. The implication of that is as these things spread, it causes more damage to the brain. I wanted to show you this image because it shows you in a pretty clear way, the left half of that brain is a healthy aging brain. On the right is somebody with late stage advanced Alzheimer's disease. And I don't show this to be grotesque or to scare you. I show you this because sometimes when we are taking care of somebody that we care a lot about, we are tempted to think that if they just tried harder, they could remember. Or if they weren't so stubborn and just did what we asked them to do, things could be a lot better. So I want you to remember this brain, right? Because that's the lens through which they're trying to interact with you, right? They may be trying even harder than you are to do the things that you want them to do, but they're living through this lens. It's a very real neurological condition that affects people in pretty dramatic ways. And some of you don't need to know that, right? You already know it because of your daily experience. But sometimes we needed to be reminded they might be trying really hard. And they're trying to make sense of what you're saying, and they're trying to have meaningful connection, a meaningful life through just a brain that has been ravaged by these little, tiny, microscopic problems, right? So it's just a reminder. So as people live with this, their memory and thinking become increasingly impaired, more problematic. So some symptoms that people will experience, even in the early stages, so forgetfulness, especially short-term, not long-term, quite as much. Asking the same questions over and over. Word-finding problems. So for me in clinic, this is something that people come in with all the time now. I can't come up with the right word. I can't come up with the right name. I've always been able to do it. Or I've always had problems with names, and now it's a little bit worse. You know, we all have this tip-of-the-tongue phenomenon. You know, it's hard to come up with the word. In Alzheimer's disease, we're talking about it much more severe and much more pervasive. If you forget things once in a while, you don't need to worry. If you can't come up with the right word once in a while, you don't need to worry. It is when you're starting to have these problems much more consistently, and the people who you care about and trust are saying, I think it's time to go check this out. All right. Difficulty with familiar tasks, we talked a little bit about that. People with Alzheimer's disease, because of their significant memory problems, can misplace items. Maybe they spend the money and they don't recall. So they kind of fill in the blanks and think somebody must have taken it, right? And you think, well, that seems a bit paranoid, but what's really happening is not paranoia, but having zero memory for having spent that money, right? Or having a conversation. If you want to know what that might feel like, imagine I came up to you as a complete stranger and say, didn't you enjoy the lunch that we shared together yesterday? And you look at me and you think, what is he talking about? We didn't have lunch. I've never met this person. So when you confront a person with Alzheimer's disease about something they've forgotten, they have no memory of it whatsoever, right? And no amount of prodding is going to bring that memory back. We'll talk some more about why that might be. Confusion about time and place, getting lost, like my grandfather. Incidentally, we do have a resource here you should check out for getting lost and finding people, so make sure you check it out if that's a concern. So we're getting to the last bit of the difficult information about Alzheimer's, and I know we'll be glad to be done with it, but when we talk about treatment, we live in an era where people get a diagnosis and they think, okay, I've got this problem, but I know there's a treatment, so it's going to be okay. And there are treatments for Alzheimer's disease, but they're not what we would hope, right? So for people who are diagnosed with Alzheimer's today, this year, next year, what they can expect is that they'll continue to have decline. They'll need to rely on other people for things they used to be able to do for themselves, and that we currently don't have a way to stop this process, unfortunately. So I am just a psychologist and I don't prescribe medicines, but I am aware of what the current medications are, so I want to share a bit of information with you. So most of the first line medications you'll take for Alzheimer's disease are what we call symptomatic. They're designed to boost your memory as much as possible by affecting certain chemicals in the brain. These medicines have been around for 20, 30 years, and the fairest assessment of these is that they don't bring people back to their baseline, they don't reverse symptoms, but they can provide some benefit for some people for a period of time, okay? This is an expectation issue. If you expect that you've gotten a diagnosis and you're going to take the medicine and it's going to bring back all those memories, I hate to tell you, but that's not how these work. Okay. That's not how they were designed, and it's not how they work, and Alzheimer's disease is a very stubborn and difficult condition to treat medically. So there are some new drugs, actually, and this is a big development in Alzheimer's science and treatment, and these are not symptomatic, these are disease-modifying treatments. Now, I didn't come here to talk to you about the treatments, but I want you to be aware that they're out there. So I talked a little bit earlier about amyloid and the development of amyloid plaques. These new medications that are out there are designed to slow the development of those amyloid plaques and actually remove them, which is huge. It's a massive step forward for the field. The unfortunate part is they're really good at clearing plaques, but unfortunately they haven't been really good at improving functioning, okay? So there's a lot more work to be done here, but if you hear about some of these medicines, I don't know if they offer them in your area or not, probably, but Leqembi is the one that you're likely to see. There was one on the market until earlier this month that they pulled. And there's another one that Eli Lilly is going to hopefully have FDA approval for this month. Again, I don't want to spend our time talking about medications. I just want you to be aware of what they are, and I want you to have appropriate expectations, right? They are a game changer in terms of the science. It's a huge breakthrough. But unfortunately, they're not a game changer in terms of daily functioning, and I'm sorry for that. So when we talk about Alzheimer's, we know that age is one of the biggest risk factors, and so as people live longer, we see more Alzheimer's disease. And We know that there are at least 6 million people in the U.S. alone, 55 million worldwide living with Alzheimer's disease. We expect the number of people who get Alzheimer's to continue to rise in the coming decades. It's a huge, huge expense on the healthcare system. And in fact, these new medications and the technology that goes with them are even more expensive. And there's still no cure, unfortunately. So, I probably don't need to ask this question. I think I just spent 20 minutes or so why this is so devastating for people. But it is true that people tend to be, at least in middle to late life, tend to be more afraid of Alzheimer's disease than other conditions, right? At least that's what surveys tell us. So why is it so devastating? What's different about it? So if you think about what's happening in Alzheimer's disease, it affects not just our body and our functioning, but it affects our memory. It affects our ability to relate and connect with other people. It affects the ability for people to understand us, especially when we get into the later stages. You know, sometimes we, you know, people say it, a person with Alzheimer's, sometimes they don't even seem like the same person anymore, right? So cancer does a lot of damage, but this is a little bit different, right? It's affecting who we are. And one of the things that led me to write the book that was referred to earlier was, you know, talking to people of faith who wondered, you know, if part of the core of who I am is what I believe, what if Alzheimer's steals that away from me, right? What is that? Where will that leave me? If my hope is in the Lord, but I can't remember him, what's gonna happen next? That's for people of faith. I won't make assumptions about what you believe, but for people who believe, that's pretty devastating, right? So what I wanna do is spend the next half hour before our break talking through some of those things. And there's a real need to consider hope, as was said as we started today. And so, what we're going to talk about is biblical hope for living with Alzheimer's disease. We've talked about how difficult it can be. We'll talk about how difficult caregiving can be this afternoon. But I just want to spend some time talking about some biblical perspectives on life and remembering and see what God has for us here. So there are several biblical sources of hope, and one is God's call to remember him. Now, if you're paying attention, you know I just highlighted how remembering and forgetting is such a big problem for people with Alzheimer's disease. So you may think that seems like an interesting way to say there's hope in remembering when you have a problem with forgetting. But I hope you'll stick with me because I think we do have some good ways to remember even in this context. There's hope in that God fully knows us and intercedes for us, and that God promises to never forget us. So let's jump in. So when I started on this process of writing this book, I was hoping to write a book about how to live well with dementia, because there's one thing that's true about Alzheimer's is as we've tried to raise awareness about Alzheimer's disease, we've also unintentionally scared people to death, right? We've talked about how bad it can be, and we've left people with the impression that there's no way to actually live well with something like Alzheimer's disease or have a meaningful life. And I felt like I couldn't write that book without connecting this to what Scripture says about who we are and whose we are and what we're about. What really surprised me as I started on this process is how much remembering and forgetting are in the Bible. You see it all over the Old Testament in the people of Israel, just as an example. You know, they are, you know, being held in Egypt. They're, you know, suffering under oppression. And if you know the biblical story of the Exodus, you know, God sends the 10 plagues, parts the Red Sea, the whole nation leaves, you know, through the parted waters. Something you'd think, I would never forget that. If I saw something like that, it would forever change my view. I would never forget that God is faithful, right? Because he just did this amazing thing. Well, the story says that they felt that way for a very brief amount of time until the heat came, right? Until they ended up in the wilderness and they forgot. And it wasn't they forgot that God did it. It was that they forgot his faithfulness and that he was for them. And they forgot that he had promised to take them through this into the promised land. And so all over Exodus and then into Deuteronomy, we see this call to remember. God calls us to remember him, his faithfulness in our lives in the past, his promise to be with us in the difficulties of the present, and he promises something better for our future. It's everywhere. New Testament, we can just look at the last days of Jesus where he is about to leave his disciples and he shares the Last Supper with them. And he breaks bread, shares the wine, and says, do this in remembrance of me, an object lesson in remembering. It's as if God knows that we are prone to forget and that we will do much better when we remember him. So we see it everywhere. And how do we do this in the context of Alzheimer's disease and dementia? So we've done a good job of highlighting how memory fails, right? We know that in people with Alzheimer's disease, it's typically in the area of short-term memory loss. And the reason for that is that one of the brain structures that's heavily damaged is the hippocampus. So the hippocampus is in your temporal lobes, just on the inside of your temple, right? It's right there. It's damaged early and heavily in Alzheimer's. And so what the hippocampus does, one of the things that it does, is it transfers things that you are experiencing and stores it in long-term memory so that you can access it later. So for you to remember what I'm talking about with you today, your hippocampus needs to take this information, the thing that your focus is on right now, and put it away like in a file cabinet or stored on your hard drive. That's what the hippocampus does. Now, if you have any experience with file cabinets or hard drives, you know that if you don't save things there and you go back to find them later, they're not there, right? You can go to the file cabinet, you can chide it, you can shake it, you can try to get it to do something to bring the file back, but you didn't put it there. So it's not there. And so for people, even in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease, that forgetting is due to a problem with storing the new memory, okay? So when we talk about where memory is weak, it's the most recent information. You know, anything past probably 15, 20 minutes is the hardest thing to remember. So what you had for breakfast, if you had breakfast, what did you do yesterday? What did you do last week? These are the hardest things for people with Alzheimer's to remember, okay? So when we talk about what we've done in terms of highlighting memory in Alzheimer's research and clinical care, we know where the problem is. It's the recent and new information. It's really hard to learn new things when you have a really damaged storage system in your memory. But what we haven't done is talk about where memories are relatively stronger, right? And so some of you who are involved in Alzheimer's care have probably discovered this. And when I was writing this book, one of the things that really surprised me is how much people had already experienced these relatively spared memory systems. So there are three of them. So one is older autobiographical memories. That's psychology speak for your memories from long ago. Right, your personal storage, your personal memories that were stored long ago. Those are relatively spared, at least for the early and middle stages of Alzheimer's. I said relatively, so it isn't exactly the same, but it's much stronger than what happened this morning. Second is procedural memory. Procedural memory refers to the old saying, it's like riding a bike, right? We say that because if you learn to ride a bike, you did it so many times that you don't have to think about it, right? You never really walk up to a bike and consciously think through the steps that you have to take in order to get on the bike and to pedal and to make it go. You can be thinking, and often are, about something else. That's a procedural memory, something that has repeated so many times that you don't have to think about it to remember. So they're memories for actions, habits, and skills. The last one is emotional memory. And we know the least about emotional memory, but that's changing. But it's the memory for how things felt. So there's good emerging evidence now in Alzheimer's research that sometimes people don't remember what you said or did, but they remembered the way you made them feel, right? So when you'll hear stories, sometimes people say, I don't even think they remembered what I said. They maybe don't even know who I am, but they are always really happy to see me, right? And that can be a trace of emotional memory. Compared to the recent information that short-term memory, these are much stronger, okay? So when we're thinking about how to care for somebody with Alzheimer's disease, if you want to love them well, if you wanna show them grace in the way that you interact with them, you wanna meet them where they're stronger. You wanna meet them where they can still engage easier than they do if you were to quiz them about what they did this morning or last week. So how do you do this? What does it look like? And so this can be in the context of your caregiving, but it also is important if you're thinking about what role the church could play or what would an Alzheimer's disease ministry look like. You have to not only know your people and their stories, but you need to understand these aspects of the way the disease affects their memory and functioning. Okay, so the first is engage their stories. And so if we're in the context of a church as we are today, these might include people's stories of faith, but it can also be engaging their stories at all, right? It doesn't have to be their testimony. It could just be engaging them in things that happened in their life long ago, right? And I was talking to somebody earlier this morning about their care for people in this stage, and they put it really well. You have to figure out how to learn to reminisce without asking questions, right? It's a great way to put it. Because when you start conversations with somebody with Alzheimer's disease with these three little words, do you remember? Just know that that's where they're weakest, right? It is, it's almost, like talking to somebody who has, significant visual problems and asking them, do they like the view, right? So we need to figure out how to engage people in a slightly different way. You can engage people in these stories, and the point here is not to fix their memory problems. The point is to engage them in remembering. And remembering has all sorts of benefits, and we know where they're least likely to remember, and we know where they're more likely to remember. So these stories might be a little bit different. They might not be as linear. There might be a bit more repetition. What I'd encourage you to do is listen for what the person is trying to tell you rather than the exact words. Sometimes you have to fill in the blanks a little bit. There are many stages of life, as you know. If you're looking for what areas people are more likely to remember, there's what we call a reminiscence bump, that people have more memories of late adolescence and early adulthood. A lot happens in that time, right? Some psychologists will say that's where a lot of our identity is formed. It's also a time with significant brain development that affects memory. So if you're looking for, where to cast to catch a fish, that's a good place to start. So if you are around people with Alzheimer's disease, you know that sometimes people progress to a point where they can't do this very well anymore. They can't generate the story like they used to. And as my new colleague who I met earlier said, you have to figure out how to do this without asking questions. And so one of the things that you can think about is you may need to start telling their story for them, right? So instead of asking them about something, say, I remember the story that you told me before about this, and then fill in the blanks. That is a way of loving people and helping them remember. You just have different expectations for their response. Some people with Alzheimer's live long enough that they can no longer speak. So one way you can be interacting with them is to tell them those stories. Right? That's a way of prompting a remembering. And you may not know if it worked, right? But it is a way of stepping in, showing up faithfully in love. Use multiple sensory modalities to help prompt remembering. So vision, old photographs, hearing, familiar music. We'll talk more about that. Favorite objects, whatever those might be. Smells have a powerful impact on remembering. You know, smell is one of the only sensory system that goes directly from the olfactory system to the brain with no intermediary steps. There's no guessing why it's so powerful. And what you're doing here, again, is just trying to love people well and step in and help them remember. So when I was writing Second Forgetting, I invited caregivers to tell me their stories about remembering and faith. And one woman shared her story with me about having to put her mother in, you know, a nursing home, a memory care setting. And she never wanted to. And she, in fact, promised her mother she would never do that, which is always a dangerous promise to make because you just never know what people's care needs might be and whether you'll be able to provide them. And she knew it would be difficult for herself. She knew it would be difficult for her mother. But what she didn't realize was one of the difficulties she hadn't anticipated for herself is that she was then going to need to go through all of her mother's things and decide what to do with them. But what she did was she took it as an opportunity to create, in a sense, a tool of remembering. So she found photographs in her mother's boxes of things. She found, you know, scripture passages she had written out, poems, and she put them together in a couple of volumes, you know, like picture books for her. She brought them to her mother, gave them to her at the nursing home, and her mother would just page through them, you know, quietly. Sometimes they'd talk together. And her mother doesn't remember receiving them, right? Because that new information is hard to retain. But each day it was like a new gift for her, right? And so it is just an act of love trying to help her remember. Let's talk about the procedural memories. We said it's like riding a bike. When we're talking about remembering in the context of faith, there are all sorts of things that churches do over and over and over again, right? Like when you're a kid or you're a teenager, you're like, ugh, we always do the same thing. Turns out that that can be pretty useful later on, right? So familiar songs and hymns, especially the old ones, familiar scripture, well-known prayers, the Lord's Prayer. Some of these things get deeply embedded in our procedural and emotional memory systems. So I hear so many stories about, you know, somebody who has Alzheimer's disease, you know, maybe a family member goes to visit them in a care setting. You know, one woman talked to me about her mother, and she was so excited to bring her to a church service that was happening in the nursing home. The chaplain was going to do it. Chaplain did a little message, sermonette kind of thing, and she was so disappointed to see that her mother just looked like she was asleep the whole time, right? And she thought, ugh. You know, what's going to work? And then they started doing songs, right? And, you know, whatever the familiar hymn, you can fill in the blanks, but for her, it was Amazing Grace, right? And so everybody's singing Amazing Grace. And while this daughter is essentially mourning that her mother isn't connecting anymore, she takes a closer look and sees that she's actually mouthing all the words as they go through. She is a person who is deeply forgetful. But in that moment, an old familiar song helps her remember. It doesn't take away the Alzheimer's disease. It doesn't change her life forever. But if you are living in a parched place, it's hot and dry, and somebody offers you a cool drink of water, that's pretty valuable, right? Wouldn't you take it? And that remembering, in a sense, can be like that cool cup of water. I want to share a quick story about my other grandfather who developed Alzheimer's disease. And like my other grandfather, a good man, faithful man. He was a longtime deacon and elder in his church, very gentle man. But when he developed Alzheimer's disease, he became quite difficult. In fact, he was aggressive, right? And my grandmother really had to put him into a memory unit. Once he was there, he alternated between being very withdrawn and apathetic and very aggressive. So when people would come into the room, he would kick them out. You know, in many ways, I think looking back on it, he was probably in danger of being kicked out of the place himself. But what happened was the pastor from his church came to visit him. And this was a new pastor, a young guy, and he walked in and said, "Hello, Adrian, do you know who I am?" Not the greatest way to start. That was the end of the visit. Grandpa kicked him out. And so the pastor said, it goes to my grandmother and said, "Well, what do I do with him? You know, how am I supposed to do this?" And she just, as only she could, just said, "I'm sure you'll figure it out," right? And to his credit, he did. He came back and he brought his Bible. He didn't know my grandfather, but he knew things about him, which is important. And he knew that scripture was important. So he decided the tact of familiar scripture. And he started reading Psalm 23 to him. And again, it would be totally fine just to read Psalm 23 and let him listen. But he did a little bit better. Pretty good for a young guy. He started to read Psalm 23. He said, "The Lord is my," and then he stopped. And my aggressive, apathetic grandfather says, "Shepherd." He goes to the next line, and they work their way back and forth through Psalm 23. So here's a man, my grandfather, right, who is in many ways unmanageable, right? He is a problem patient at the memory unit. But when he is approached in areas of strength that are important to him, where he can remember, he has this brief remembrance, right? And I'm not saying it took away his Alzheimer's, and it didn't make him not aggressive when things went wrong, when he didn't understand how people were trying to take care of him. But the point was, somebody approached him in love and tried to help him remember by looking at areas where he was strong. The emotional memory piece also comes down to just our way of being with people. We need to learn to slow down, to be patient, to pray for guidance as we interact with people. You know, trust the Spirit will lead us. Show people love and honor, right? So I don't know what it's like to live with late stage Alzheimer's disease, but it must be very difficult and be very confusing. I'm sure you want people to treat you with dignity and respect. So it's a way of being, and it's hard. I mean, if you take care of somebody with Alzheimer's disease, it's hard to slow down and just see the person. I get that. But when we think about how we're interacting with people, we also want to attend to how we make them feel. And if you're finding yourself in a situation where you can't slow down and you feel like you can't see this, that's when you need to reach out and get some help, right? Okay, so what I'm talking about here is not changing the trajectory of dementia and Alzheimer's disease. I'm talking about sacred moments where the person remembers. And we have to think about these in a little bit different way. We're so used to thinking, what is the thing that I can do that's going to change this for good? And what I'm saying is, we want to love people well, and they may remember in the moment that's meaningful to them. They may not remember. They may not be able to tell you about it. It would have been a huge mistake to go into my grandfather's room and say, "Hey, tell me about that thing that happened with the pastor. What were you feeling? Did you remember?" You know, it may be gone. But in that moment, that experience of remembering and grace and love matters. And I think in Alzheimer's disease, we have to shift our thinking a little bit to recognize that those things matter, even if that's not an enduring change. Okay, so I want to share a little bit about this story. Another woman wrote to me while I was writing the book, and she and her husband they had a life as missionaries. They had translated scripture into multiple languages. The church was a huge part of who they were, and their belief, you know, formed their core identity. And he had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease years ago, and she was sharing, you know, I was asking people, what could the church really provide for you in terms of support? And her request seemed pretty simple to me, right? So she says, you know, I need men who will basically show up and talk to him and understand both who he was and who he is now, not to talk about politics and sports, but people who will give him time. And the way she closed it was, you know, I'll manage, but he's slipping away. And I want people to visit with him. And so I thought, I can't be, you know, writing a book like this and have a woman say, I need men to show up. And so I tried. You know, I went and I visited their home, you know, far outside the city. You know, in a lot of ways, they were geographically and socially isolated. He was pretty homebound at that point. And so I went in and I greeted him and I said hello. And he just stared straight ahead. He didn't answer. He didn't offer his hand. I tried a couple other things, and nothing seemed to really engage him. And it was a good reminder for me, and perhaps you already know this, but people can progress to a point where some of these things we've been talking about just don't seem to work. And that can leave you, and perhaps you're feeling that way right now, right? You know, Dr. Mast is talking about these ways to engage people. The person I take care of, my husband, my wife, my parent, could never do those things. They're too far along. So what I want to do is just share what I think are some good scriptural encouragements about what that phase of life might look like in terms of remembering. Because Alzheimer's really does progress. So this man, you know, for all he could offer me in terms of interaction, with, once in a while he groaned, right? That was it. He really didn't have much else when I was there. And he is in a stage where it's progressed, where he is, it's hard to know him, right? I don't know what he's thinking. His wife doesn't know what he's thinking. Is he content? Is he happy? Is he bored? Is he scared? She just doesn't know because the communication has been lost. And the reminder here is that even when we can't know people, that scripture tells us that God fully knows us, he prays for us, and he promises never to forget us. Let's walk through those pretty quickly. So Psalm 190 or 139, encourage you to read it later today. Such a beautiful psalm. It talks about how the Lord even knew us when we were in our mother's wombs. It's a pretty popular psalm for that reason. But what it talks about is basically, no matter where we are, the Lord is with us. You know, when I sit, when I rise, you perceive my thoughts from afar. Before a word is on my lips, you know it completely. So for this man who can barely speak, the Lord knows him. Where can I flee from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? It closes, you know, search me, God, and know my heart, know my anxious thoughts. It's a reminder to me that the Lord knows us better than we know ourselves, right? And it isn't limited by things like Alzheimer's and communication. The second is God intercedes for us. So Romans 8, amazing passage in many ways. But this one says, in the same way the Spirit helps us in our weakness, we do not know what we ought to pray for. We don't know how to pray. And this is a passage not about Alzheimer's disease. Like, we don't know how to pray. We don't know what to pray for. But the Holy Spirit is always interceding for us, always praying on our behalf in accordance with the will of God. So in this context, not only does the Lord know this man, David, who has descended deep into dementia, he knows him, he's interceding for him, he holds on to him, and he promises he will never forget him. So Isaiah 49 says, can a mother forget the baby at her breast and have no compassion on the child she has born? Unimaginable, right? Though she may forget, I will not forget you. Our names are written, as the passage goes on to say, on the palms of his hands. He will never forget us. And so when we're thinking about remembering and forgetting in this, the biblical call to remember, one of the things that is important for you to remember is that it's much more significant that God remembers us than we remember him, right? If I had the choice, and I don't get the choice, between me remembering God and God remembering me, I'm going to choose the latter every time, right? That when people are in this stage where it's hard for them to remember, it's a great comfort to know that God holds on to them. He knows the depths of our heart better than we do. He's praying for them, and he promises to never forget them. And so this is the last thing I want to leave with you, and I'll be back with you this afternoon. But there's so much pain in Alzheimer's, right? There's pain for the person who's experiencing it. There is pain for those who are looking on. It's not always suffering. Not everybody with Alzheimer's is the same. But I want to emphasize that for those of us who believe, you know, Alzheimer's doesn't get the last word, right? So Revelation 21 talks about the new heaven and the new earth. And let me just read it for you, and then I'll wrap up. So it says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, and I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain. There'll be no Alzheimer's disease. There'll be no more confusion. There'll be no more forgetting. And we won't need to remember the Lord because we'll be right there with him. For the old order of things has passed away. He who is seated on the throne said, 'I am making everything new.'" So whatever we experience in this life, we can take heart, we take hope. God is with us. He's calling us to remember him. Remember the faithfulness in the past. Remember he's with you in the present, and remember that he gives you and promises a better future. So these are just some questions to consider, but these sum up some ideas, and I'm gonna close out of time with this question. So what is God prompting you to remember today? You know, whether you have Alzheimer's or you're caring for somebody or you're just curious about this, what is God calling you to remember? We all have a bit of spiritual amnesia when things get hard. So what does God want you to remember in the midst of this trial?
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please subscribe to this channel if you've not already done so, and leave a review if you found this content helpful.